Okay, so again, if you just slid in here and didn't hear the beginning, I am not Walt. I am Phil Dickey, and I am indeed pleased to be here with you guys this morning to talk a little bit about postmodernism and what effect that has had on the church. So, in case you missed out last week, Walt talked a little bit about modernity and the role that that had in liberal theology and the role that had on the church and how those two had influence on one another and were kind of simultaneous. And so, I thought we'd open with a little fill in the blank. I'm sure you remember this, right? Matthew 6:24 says, "You cannot serve God and or modernity." So that would be the more postmodern response to what we get now, is that you cannot serve God and modernity. It just doesn't happen. You just can't do it. And so liberalism, just as a little bit of a reminder, embraced the idea of modernism, starting with the idea of Descartes and his sharp lines that he drew between subject and object and the private and the public and the sacred and the profane. The modern experiential method looked at empirical facts, believable, provable truth. This is what we really leaned on with modernism, and then liberalism leaned into that as well. Faith depends on facts. It's not factual. It's not true. Achieve enlightenment ideals, right? Everything has got to be provable. We got into the scientific method, looking at what that looks like. And if you remember, Walt talked about this coming out of Princeton, where Princeton was really just, they were hell-bent on the idea that they were going to prove faith. Right? Exactly. That should be a little bit of an oxymoron, but that was what they were bent to do, was they were going to get to the point of being able to prove all of this existed. So you could fill in the blank on this as well, right? Blank happens. Shift happens, right? Like, Walt talked about the idea that liberalism really led to this idea of a huge paradigm shift within the understanding of religion and the understanding of faith. And that the big shift that he talked about was this inward turn. And he referenced this idea that the move from the text and the external world to this inner world of experience. If you remember, he referenced Immanuel Kant as well as Friedrich Schleiermacher as the kind of the two people who were real big leaders and influencers in this. The Pietist influence, they both were influenced by Pietism. He talked about that they grew up in Pietist families, had Pietist education. And if you remember Pietism from back with John Wesley and all of that fun stuff, it's very much about the inner experience. If you remember back to Wesley, even like on his trip across the sea to his missionary journey in Georgia, he was very troubled by the fact that the Pietists were so assured of their faith and of their salvation whenever the waters got a little rough on the ship, and he was not so sure what was going to happen whenever he died, if he was going to die on this boat. And he was jealous of the Pietist assurance movement that he was experiencing. So liberalism leads to fundamentalism. And Walt mentioned this just briefly, and I think he's going to come back and touch on this some more in a week or two. It was, again, a reaction against liberalism, whereas the Bible is seen as propositions. And so anything we need to understand about Revelation, we really find in the Bible. And that's kind of the extent of it. You find it there. If you want to look a little of this, I'm sure, again, Walt's going to cover this more, but you can look up Carl Henry. He's one of the big fundamentalist movement who really came as a response to the liberal theology. Another one was postmodernism. So, right? So you had modernism, and then there was this move to postmodernism. But it wasn't a rejection completely of modernity in the same way that fundamentalism was. Fundamentalism really like was an antithesis kind of modernity. Postmodernism wasn't a full rejection, but more of a complex and ambivalent attitude toward modernity. Okay? So within postmodern theology, the focus is on intellectual issues, the objectivity and absoluteness of statements, the interpretation of texts, and the limitation and bias of language. Yes, ma'am. Well, that's a phenomenal question. And it's kind of like shooting a moving target. People would say we are in postmodernity. Postmodernism was a movement and an idea that began early in the 20th century. Some people, like, I think that a lot of the actual writing that happened on it wasn't until the 70s, actually, which we'll talk about here in a little bit. We'll get to some of that. But the influence and the idea and the movement of it was early 20th century, primarily following World War II. The World Wars were really what led us into the idea of postmodernism, where we thought that enlightenment and intellectualism was really going to be the result of it, and we could intellectualize ourselves to be moral people, and then we figured out in the World Wars that apparently we can't. We haven't been able to do that. And so a lot of this came out of the aftermath of the World Wars, and specifically World War II. So postmodernism asks questions, and this is, you could just stop there. Postmodernism asks a lot of questions, but primarily in the beginning, the questions they were asking was, what or who authorizes the power certain discourses have to explain the world? Right? So fundamentalism is going to say the Bible is going to be that authority. Modernism is going to say, what gives the Bible authority? Postmodernism is going to say that. Other questions, what basis are certain forms of explanation privileged when all explanations are the way we tell the story ourselves? Right? It's all very subjective still. So suspicion is a really important word whenever we get into the idea of postmodernism. One guy I looked at, he actually wrote an essay called Suspicion of Suspicions. Like, the suspicion toward modernity's ideas of factual and truth, it questions what is overlooked. And so think of a story, right? So this is kind of the way postmodernism goes about to think about this kind of stuff. What is overlooked? Think of a story. When we look at a story, we're selectively choosing how to tell a story. So anytime you recount a story, you're selectively including what you're going to put in there, and you're distorting that story by choosing what you're not going to put in there, right? Now, if you're me, it's because you don't remember all the details, and you just remember selectively things anyway. But often it's because we're intentional in what we omit, but also we emphasize that which we include. And so you can see how then as we get into the Bible and we get into the Gospels, and we'll talk about this here in a little bit too with the idea of post-liberal, which we'll get into, is the idea of the Gospels, if you read the Synoptic Gospels, they're synoptic, similar, but they're not the same, right? There's different emphasis on different things, and there's omissions of things as well. So there's subjectiveness in the story, okay? Postmodernism is rooted in secular theology, which also should kind of make you giggle a little bit and go, huh? That's kind of an oxymoron too. This comes from a neo-Orthodox tradition, which Harvey Cox you may or may not have heard of, but this name you will have heard of, I'm sure. Dietrich Bonhoeffer falls in the realm of this. And so again, back to this kind of like World War II era, right, of this secular theology. And Bonhoeffer said, God would have us know that we must live as men who manage our lives without him. Before God and with God, we live without God. God lets himself be pushed out of the world onto the cross. We'll build on that a little bit more here in a minute. Existentialism as well. And so Kierkegaard, I'm sure you've heard of as well. Doubt is an element of faith. It is impossible to gain any objective certainty about religious doctrines. As well as Paul Tillich is a little bit more of a contemporary than Kierkegaard if you've studied Paul Tillich. Secular theology had this strong influence on liberal theology. Thank you. Liberation theology in this idea of the death of God theologies in the 1960s. So I'm sure you heard of death of God with Nietzsche. And then we get into this idea of radical theology, which if you've ever read any of Jack Caputo, I actually have just been exploring radical theology a little bit in the last year, about a year and a half. And there's a more contemporary Peter Rollins who's doing a lot of work now. Jack Caputo's still alive and still doing a lot of work. But Peter Rollins is very much alive and active, and he's a Northern Ireland guy. And he has this whole idea of pyrotheology is what he calls it. And it's basically the idea that whatever you can't burn away in your theology has become your God. So if you have the idea of, like, God is always comforting us, well, has comfort become your God at that point? So it's really interesting. So he works on this. We'll talk about pyrotheology here in a second, too. But Thomas Altazar is another one who was real big in this. And God is immanent because he empties himself in Christ. And this is the really important idea of kenosis, which if you remember in Philippians 2, Christ fully... I just lost the quote in my head. He emptied himself. Thank you. That was the word I was looking for. Emptied himself, coming in the form of human, emptying himself from heaven to come on down, right? The whole idea of kenosis is the idea of emptying God's own self. So they take this idea of kenosis, and Gianni Vadamo takes the idea of agape, right? The Greek term agape, love. And it's this idea of a self-surrendering love. In the same way that we get this kenosis of Christ self-emptying himself, we get this idea of agape love as self-surrendering love. And then he talks about the idea of secularization as this, again, it's not something counter to faith. It's where we wean ourselves away from God of power to the God of love. Kenosis of the human, not just kenosis of Christ, but kenosis of the human experience, surrendering our drives for power and perfection. And this is where we get back to the idea of pyrotheology, right? What are the things that we have committed ourselves so much to that we've essentially created idols out of them, almost the characters and natures of God that we cling to more than the idea of God? Okay, are we hanging? Are we good so far? Yes, sir.
I'm going to make a statement about an observation.
This perfect.
Sounds like fringe stuff.
Fringe stuff?
Fringe, you know, like fringe.
Okay.
Not
Well, it's not really fringe because secular theology really did a lot to build on what becomes postmodern. And so if you don't have a little bit of an idea of what the secular theology was, then you don't fully grasp what happened with the postmodern, which is kind of what we're getting to now. And it's really not fringe stuff because if you look at the history of a lot of the religious movements, it's kind of the pendulum, right? It goes back and forth. And so you had liberal theology, which then led to a little bit of fundamentalism, which then it kind of swings back and forth a little bit. And so postmodern is a little bit of the swinging back, but through that swinging, we went through this term of like secular theology as well. And the reason that it's important and not fringe is because this is what was happening in a lot of the academy. So this is really influential in the academy. No, this is still early 20th century. So there is still influence of this, yes. You will still have a lot of postmodern thinkers that fall into the realm of secular theology. And again, radical theology is still a part of secular theology, which a lot of people laugh at and say, how can you have both of those things? Well, that's what they do. They live in the tension of that constantly. So is Peter Rollins a fringe theologian? Yeah, probably. Like, he's definitely not mainstream, but he still has a lot of influence in specific areas. And so I don't remember if we'll fully get into it, but is anybody familiar with the Emergent Church? So the Emergent Church movement that happened was really rooted in postmodern thought, and then it has also moved into the kind of the post-liberal thought, which we'll get to here in a few minutes too. So it does seem fringe, and sure, yeah. I wasn't living at this time, so I'm sure there was some fringe to it, right? But like, not that you were, Gib, I'm not saying that, but
In the 60s, I was born.
Sure, and so you, if you remember the death of God, that whole idea was a really big movement. And so that's where secular theology had a lot of influence into that movement, which then plays a role in postmodern theology as well. Sure, absolutely, good question. So Heidegger is another big influencer in this. He was a philosopher, not necessarily death of God, but a particular perception of God is what he really began to influence. And this idea of that it's not so much the idea that like we're killing off God, which was an argument for a while, right? But it's not the killing off God, it's the killing off of a specific understanding or perception of God. And he believed specifically that was the metaphysics understanding of God, metaphysical. And so metaphysics being a way of thinking that identifies being with what is thinkable. Yes, sir? Sure, yes. And there are some close connections back to deism. Again, that pendulum swinging, right? It's going back and forth. And so there's some influence with some early deists. But again, they're not sacrificing modernity, right? They're keeping some of what they've gone through with the modernity aspects and throwing that in with now how do we move from modernity into this realm of secular into the postmodern theology as well. So yes, there is a very much influence of deism.
And also, you heard me bringing that thought up. It was interestingly enough, probably many of the founders of our country were deists.
Sure, yeah. And it gets a little, again, it gets a little tricky because as we talked about a minute ago with this idea of kenosis, that was the immanence of God. Right, so a lot of deism was so much about the transcendence of God at the expense of immanence of God. Well, now we're meshing the two of them together, which will then kind of move down the road later to get into this idea of panentheism as well that we're not going to talk about today, but maybe Walt can talk about that some other time. Okay, so Heidegger had it so that he said the danger of confusing particular beings, those we can think of, with being itself. So this was his big deal, was the idea of being. Our efforts to grasp and thought the ultimate being. So again, it's kind of back to the idea that we end up creating God in our own image and our own limited thought, as opposed to allowing the being, right, to exist beyond our ability to even think of. This is what he really wrestled with. We wanted to just master the idea of the being of God and reduce it to instrumental values. And I think this was his response to modernity as well. Yes, sir. Yeah, so apophatic, kind of the apophatic understanding of we end up doing a lot of what we don't know about God, right? Rather than the cataphatic understanding of God. Yeah, I think we do. That's a good way to put it. You pierce through the unknowing. And it's easy to hear all this and be like, well, then what's the point, right? Like, if we just get so lost in the fringes of all this, is there really any point there? And again, if you're coming out of modernity where everything is about proving, well, you're kind of like trying to get back to the idea that we're a little bit beyond proving. Like, there are some things that can't be proved, but that doesn't mean they're not worthy. And that was Tillich's idea, was religion is actually the most important thing we can study. So it can get a little frustrating in this to think, like, what in the world is the point of all this arguing and bickering about something that seems so unclear and mysterious? And, well, we're going to get there. So here's the common criticism. It's just destructive relativism. That's all it's doing, is just destroying things and saying, you know, whatever's good for you is good for you. That's the criticism of postmodernism so often, is that there's, you know, nothing doesn't stand on anything, it's all just relativism. Another term that's often used is deconstruction, which postmoderns are actually going to grab onto and run with. They actually love this idea of deconstruction. The problem, a runaway hermeneutic of deconstruction, but it actually leads to a constant self-criticism, which leads to instability. So this is the criticism, right? Like, when you're constantly self-criticizing, that's kind of the bent of a lot of postmodernism is this idea of constant self-criticism, right? So not only are you like challenging the system, but you're challenging yourself continually as well to figure out like what really is true in this situation. So it leads to this idea of instability, which I love. The response to that then is, yeah, well, it turns out human life is kind of unstable. So if human life is unstable, why would we expect anything less from our experience of trying to understand the divine, much less the relation of the human experience to the divine? It is unstable. So what would Jesus, almost, deconstruct? What would Jesus deconstruct? And that is actually a book title. So Jack Caputo, John D. Caputo there, he wrote this in a series. I forgot the publisher on there. The Good News of Postmodernism for the Church. And there's a whole series that this is a part of, and I forgot the publisher. I didn't write it down, sorry. The what? Oh, is it up there? The Church in Postmodern Culture was the name of the series. Baker, maybe? Anyway. But that's what he really got to this point, was deconstruction's a huge part of this. And so in Caputo's book, he actually he talks about the whole movement of the What Would Jesus Do movement, and how that really leads us into this idea of figuring out that deconstruction is actually quite necessary for the things that we're doing in faith. And it's kind of back to the idea of pyrotheology. Like, what do we need to deconstruct and to burn away to get to the core and the essence behind what we've covered it with? And so Derrida is really kind of the big name. If you just typed in Google and postmodernism or philosophy, postmodern philosophy, Derrida would probably be one of the first names that comes up. And he says deconstruction isn't something that we do to things. Deconstruction happens. We don't have to do it. It's constantly happening. It's a way of reinventing. And so he does a lot of going through and looking at the way that Jesus actually deconstructs a whole lot of things, all with the idea of reinventing. Now, the problem becomes, I think a lot of criticism that happens with postmodernism also, is that there's a lot of deconstruction and there's not a lot of reinventing. And I think that's been my experience, which we'll get to here in a few minutes, with a lot of, we'll call them millennial postmodernists, is there's a lot of deconstruction. People love to jump on the deconstruction idea. There's not a lot of building back. So Derrida said, you start with what you inherited, right? We all come from somewhere. We all have a context. you come from a faith context, more than likely, right? Even if your family wasn't a specific faith, like wherever you grew up, there's some kind of faith context that surrounds you to some extent. You grow up with a body, right? You grow up with a gender. There's all these things that you grew up with that you inherited that have to be deconstructed and then reinvented to really figure out the core of what's there. The reality of deconstruction among millennials. So this is what Walt had told me. He said, I really want you to teach on this because you're in the midst of it. You're working in the midst of this. And so I thought, well, okay, what can I tell that shares a little bit of the idea that I experience in the kind of the day-to-day ministry aspects of postmodernism? So what I see so often deals more with what Heidegger said of the death of a certain perception of God. And I think a lot of this happens, or at least it happened for me, and I've seen it happen to a lot of the people that I've worked with, a lot of students that I've worked with, but I think that it's happening at a younger and younger age now. So what happened for me in college was I grew up in a pretty, to say fundamentalist is probably an exaggeration, but we just didn't know any better, right? I don't know if we were fundamentalists or not. We just didn't know any better. I'm from Podunk, Missouri, where there's like 8 Baptist churches, like 4 Assemblies of God churches, and 1 Methodist church, and somehow I wound up in the Methodist one. I don't know if that's grace or providence or what it is, but I ended up there for whatever it was, really because that's where my friends were, but that's how I ended up there. And you know, a lot of us didn't know to question or know that there was another option out there until I got to college and had no idea what I was going to study, and then I started studying religion at a secular university, public university, and then realized that a lot of the things I had been told were not what they were telling me in the college classroom. Now, luckily for me, I went to college 30 minutes from my hometown where a lot of my friends were there. I had a mentor that worked with me throughout my entire time of college. So I had a safe space to process all of that. But what I find a lot of times here at SMU and working with college students in general is that they come to college with this specific certain perception of God that has been sheltered, right, for their entire youth and growing up. And then they come sit in a classroom and they find out that there's 2 creation stories in the Bible. What do you mean? I literally, we sat in here at lunch one day and I had a college student tell me, there are not. And I said, grab a Bible. Like, open to Genesis 1, read it, and then read Genesis 2. Well, they're not different. Okay. It's always right to kind of bite your tongue, right? Do we want to define the word different, or what are we going to go with here? I was a little more gentle with him at that point. I wasn't quite as harsh. But these are the things that happen, though, right? They grow up with a certain perception, a certain experience, and a lot of them don't ever get questioned, or they don't see anything beyond what they know. And so when they come to college and they begin to experience this, and this is why I love doing this with college students here at a safe space like this, as opposed to in a classroom where a lot of times they're going to really get challenged. And then it's the idea of a brick wall, right, where they start taking away a couple bricks here and there of what has been built for them, and then all of a sudden it all comes crumbling down, which has led to so much of the nuns, right? You've heard about the nuns and a lot of the research. Because there was never this building up or allowing them to see another perspective or another viewpoint. And so at some point, this God that they've known dies. It dies to them. And so we try to create a space where they can do that, you know, where it's safe, as opposed to in a classroom where it can sometimes be hostile. Now, most of the professors that I know over at SMU aren't typically hostile about it, but they do love to get a little roused out of students, you know? And depending on how solid they are in their faith depends on how much that rouse gets them going. Yes, oh gosh, what? I'm just kidding. when your boss is here and asks you questions in the middle of your presentation, you never know. Okay. Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah. Yeah, no, that's perfect. Yes, ma'am. Yeah, and actually there's a whole lot of work that's done in the idea of weakness. Those are the slides that didn't make it into the presentation today. But there's a whole lot of, it's back to the idea of kenosis, right? It's the idea of the self-emptying, not only in Christ that we read in Philippians, but also in the way that we do theology and in the way that God operates and just the way that we operate within creation as well. It's a constant self-emptying that takes the form of weakness as opposed to strength or power. And that's what, a lot of postmodernism is questioning structures and questioning the status quo, kind of. So another name for postmodern is post-structuralism. That's where Derrida came from, was this idea of post-structuralism. And so, again, if you look that up, you'd find this term synonymous with postmodernism, is the challenging of the structure and the challenging of the way things have always been in the system. It's exactly what it is. Yeah, dismantling of the scientific mind. Yes. Not being limited to the scientific mind. Oh, thank you. That's very kind of you. Look at that. That's lovely. Okay. So you'll hear things out of this, and people will get to this idea of I'm spiritual but not religious, right? Because we're okay holding on to the something that's there, right? I actually looked up the word agnostic and kind of where it became really. Do you want to guess where the height of its usage in the English language was? Right around the turn of the 20th century. Right around the same time all of this was happening. The idea of agnosticism really just like shoots up. Because we want to get rid of all the systems that are tying us down, but we don't want to throw the baby out the bathwater. We want to hold on to something there. And so, yeah, I'm spiritual, but I'm not religious, right? And you've heard a million responses to this that, you know, you can't throw out the church with it and have the body of Christ, right? It turns out they're wedded. So there's just something that goes along with this, but this is what people are deconstructing, right? This is the process of deconstruction. And this is, again, what Derrida said is this happens naturally. It's not something that we do. And like you said also, it's something that finds you rather than you having to find it. Another idea is post-colonialism. So a lot of work has been done in the idea that so much of power, even in religion, comes from dead white male German theologians, right? I mean, that's just really what it comes down to. And so deconstructing the power systems that are surrounded by that as well. In the foreword of that book that I showed of Jack Caputo, Brian McLaren talks about the fact that you can't separate post-colonialism from postmodernism as well. They're very much wedded together too. And so if you're going to invest in one, you have to invest in the other and recognize that there's subjugation. Yes. Okay. That's exactly right. And so a lot of liberation theologists have huge influence in postmodernism, and a lot of postmodernism has huge influence in liberation. Yeah, that's the thing, right? So whenever you say what time frame is this, we can kind of put a time frame on it, but then when you try to start drawing like pretty timelines, it's meshing all crazy together. Like the timelines get deconstructed even, right? And you can't figure out what's going on exactly where and who's influencing who, but there's a lot of overlap that happens in all of that. Yeah, Kent. That's exactly right. And yeah, community, it's just by community, it's just by if you're on the East Coast or the West Coast or absolutely. Especially with post-colonialism and what happens with that in Latin America. Yep. It's funny, as I was prepping for this, I started like going back to my intro to theology course at Perkins, and I started realizing, oh, this is what he did. He walked us through each step of this, basically, of what happened from Bart and the separation between the divine other and us and humanity, into the idea of de las casas and post-colonialism and the idea of the significance of the other, which is a very big postmodernism. A lot of Jewish, there was a Jewish postmodern thinker who also didn't make the slides, but his whole idea was that you see God in the face of the other. And so that means we are always connected to the other, and our experience of the divine is always intertwined with the other. And it's a command that we have to be connected to the other. And so that happens within this as well. Post-structuralism, I just mentioned, was another big one that went along with this. And then pluralism as well falls into this category too, where, again, a lot of people are going to say, oh, pluralism is just another sense of relativism, but it gets to the idea of if we're going to start looking at truth, then if we can't say we hold all the truth within our little basket, right? Truth exists beyond our basket. To claim that we hold all that truth is totally anti-postmodern. And so recognizing that If we can't believe that God exists even in the form of other religion, or at least the expression of God, well, then we're missing out on the idea of the fullness of the being, right? That he talked about, Heidegger talked about, the existence of God beyond our limited language, thinking, capacity. So that's where pluralism falls into it as well. Okay, so here's that. This is Lyotard. I knew I was going to mess up his name. He wrote this lovely book called The Postmodern Condition, and this is the one that came out in 79, and it's the collapse of interdisciplinary grand meta-narratives for small stories or micro-narratives. Did you get all that? So here's how I break it down, though. Don't force my experience to fit into your story. That's what the essence of his argument is. The essence behind all of this is the experience is unique to the individual, and he really challenges the idea of the meta-narrative, but really what's behind it is you can't make these big, like, giant sweeping perceptions and ideas anymore, because it does depend on geography, and it does depend on your gender, and there's so many things that play into this, so we can't have these big sweeping meta-narratives. We have to focus more on the smaller stories, or what he called the micro-narratives, to understand the fullness of this. And here's his, well, you can't really see it anyway, but there's his book, The Postmodern Condition. And it's a report on knowledge is the subtitle. And he was followed then by Donna Haraway, who talked about all knowledge is situated, all knowledge is situated knowledge. Yeah, there we go. And so we get the ideas, like I was just saying, language, gender, race, class, historical location, and even religious location. And so she wrote in the feminist studies, one of the volumes of feminist studies, that she wrote this whole idea of situated knowledge. And it's kind of the same idea of the micro. Okay, so post what now? So now we move a little bit through the idea of postmodernism and this idea of questioning and challenging the structures and the systems and questioning truth and this idea of not all the way to relativism, but the questioning the subjective as well as objective at this point, right? We just question all of it. We can't trust any of it at this point. And we get to this idea of post-liberalism or post-liberal theology, which you may be thinking, how did, you know, another post, right? Yeah. There's actually a post-postmodernism as well, but we were not going to get into that either. So in post-liberalism or post-liberal theology, it rejects enlightenment and universal rationality, the liberal assumption of an immediate religious experience common to all humanity. So can you see the pendulum swinging a little bit already, right? We're going to start flirting again with meta-narratives. We'll get here in a second. Daniel Kirkson talk about that. And this comes out of not Princeton, but Yale in the 1980s. Yale really took this upon. A lot of the scholastic work that was being done came out of Yale Divinity in the 80s. Influences in philosophy, you had Wittgenstein. In sociology, you had Gertz and Berger. And then in theology, you had Lindbeck. Lindbeck was the third part of my Bart de las Casas, and then Lindbeck had the doctrine of, I just lost the name of the book, Nature, the Doctrine of Nature, I think, that talked a lot about the idea of language and our limitation in linguistics to understand theology and God. And then Frey, and then Hauerwas as well. And if you remember, Hauerwas was out of Duke, and there's still a lot of post-liberal theology happening in Duke under Stauerwas as well. What's that? People have opinions. So narrative theology. Emil Brunner says, faith is created through the Spirit via the narrative of God's gracious dealing with humanity. So another term for post-liberal theology is narrative theology. I think Walt actually mentioned this last week as he was kind of wrapping up. And so another one was Clark Pinnock, who said, the Bible is not a systematic theology waiting to be systematized, but a theodrama. Right? Yeah, see, I got a thumbs up over there. That's good. Now we're getting somewhere, right? So the main points of narrative theology, focus on Bible as a whole. So the dramatic account of God's activity, identify God and God's character for us, and then we get to the idea of Bible contains propositions, right? Like this is what the fundamentalist movement said. The Bible is all about propositions. Well, the post-liberal movement says, yeah, it contains propositions, but they're not independent or superior to the meta-narrative of God's saving activity. They serve the story, not vice versa. Okay? So the idea of God is love, right? That's a proposition. But what do you do with that? Do you look up the word love in the dictionary? And does that explain to you what God is love means? No, you. When you read the Bible, you begin to understand what God is love means as you read the story as a whole, right? And we'll get to the story as a whole from N.T. Wright's perspective here in just a second. So main points continued. The Bible contains many kinds of statements, not just propositional, but commands, prayers, poetry, parables, etc. All part of the great story of God, whose central character is Jesus Christ. Okay, that's an important part. You interpret everything through the lens of the Shema, right? So if you remember in Mark 12, 28 to 30, when Jesus is asked what is the most important commandment, he goes back to the Shema, which is the Deuteronomy, where he says, love the Lord your God. And the second is just like it, love your neighbor as you love yourself. Right? And so we begin to interpret everything through the lens of the Jesus narrative. And so if you're an Adam Hamilton fan, if you've read Making Sense of the Bible, this is basically what Adam does in Making Sense of the Bible. Is he takes you on a journey through what the Old Testament is, what the New Testament is, and then through some controversial issues, and basically says, all those things that you struggle with in the Old Testament, whenever you read them through the lens of the Christ event, how does that change what those look like? And he goes so far to even say, I don't know where he gets this from, I don't think it's probably original to him, but he has three baskets that he talks about. And then in one basket, there's the idea of the eternal truths of God whenever we read scripture, and that's what he would call would be the Shema, and what Jesus says, to love the Lord your God and love your neighbor. But then there's also the idea of scripture that was true in a context that it was written, and true for its time and its era, but it may not hold truth for us anymore, right? And we look at things like slavery and women's role in the church and a lot of those things like that. A lot of people use that also in the LGBTQ movement as well. But then there's also the third category is the ones that this just never actually represented the character or nature of God. This made it into scripture, but in no way can we actually get on board with it representing the character and nature of God. So go in and slaughter all the men, women, and children. Oh, and the animals as well. Not going to get on board with that one, right? It's in there. We got to do something with it. We can't just reject it and throw it out. But how do we then work with it to figure out, like, why is it in there? What's happening with it? What does that say in the overall greater narrative? Does it fit the greater narrative? To which, if we read it through the lens of the Shema, we would say, no, it really doesn't. Theology is our best attempt to understand the biblical drama or the drama story. Use of complex metaphors and doctrines. Theologians must be living the story within a community of faith shaped by the story. And I think that's really important. And I put up Raise the Aslan. Has anybody watched the Believer series that's been happening lately? Oh my goodness, it's so fun. So a lot of people really don't like Reza Aslan. He's Muslim, and he wrote a book on Jesus of Nazareth, which a lot of people had a really hard time with. I've only read excerpts of it. The parts that I've read I actually really enjoyed, but that's because, you know, I studied religion undergrad, so that's the things that I like and enjoy. But he did this series where he went to different religions, and he lived the religion. Again, he's Muslim, but so he went to Haiti, and he lived voodoo. And he went through the experiences of what it meant to be voodoo. And then he went to this post-Scientology movement. I don't know if you're familiar with Scientology and where it's going, but there's a big movement beyond the Church of Scientology now where people are still practicing Scientology. They're just deconstructing Scientology, and they're doing it on their own, which I'm sure you can imagine the Church of Scientology is not a big fan of. So what he does is he goes and he lives these experiences with the people who are in it, right? So he's not part of the community, but he's trying to figure out what's it like to be part of the community so I can write on a better understanding of this. And he made this really great document. It's on CNN. It's called Believer. It's fantastic. Believer. Yeah. I think it's five or six part, maybe. They have one on the ultra-Orthodox Jews in Jerusalem. Start there. It's so fascinating. There's a whole sect of ultra-Orthodox Jews, but all they do is the way they, like, quote-unquote evangelize, which isn't really all that popular in Judaism, is they go around and dance and have parties in the streets. And they're ultra-Orthodox, and it's hilarious. Anyway, okay. I think he treats Christianity pretty fairly. And I think he would get on board with the idea that there's a certain perception of God that has died. And if it hasn't yet, then it needs to. But yes, in especially in Jesus of Nazareth, I think he treats it at least scholastically very fairly. Yeah. And that's what he says in the series. He says, I've been studying the world of religions for 20 years now. I'm going to actually live them. And it's pretty fascinating. So, mm-hmm. So in continuing in this, doctrines are secondary to story. They can't replace story, are judged by their ability to faithfully express the character of God as revealed in the story. Right? So we're not throwing doctrines out. Doctrines are still important. But I had to write notes on my hand, too, and then I finally got it in there because I feel like I'm back in college, like, writing notes on my hand. But I read a book once with Tony Campolo where he said all doctrines are a form of idolatry if you really get down to it, because you're making a claim for God on the definitive aspect of God, which again, at that point, you're back to Heidegger, right? And you're nailing down being in thought and in thinking. So I love that. When I heard Campolo say that, I thought, oh, that's brilliant. I'm going to hold on to that little nugget. So then it gets to the task of the church, and this is important for us where we are today, right? Faithfully improve the rest of the, improvise the rest of the story. And I love this. And that's why, I don't know if you noticed in the creed we did this morning, it says God created and continues to create, right? We take part in the continued creation of this. And this is where post-liberal and narrative theology gets into the idea that we're not, well, here, I think I have it. Not only living in the story, but continue the story in their own culture and context, right? So we're in the story, we're part of the story, but we're also creating the story. We get the opportunity to write the story. And I forgot my little prop this morning, but my daughter the other day got a gift from probably her Nana or somebody. Instead of a book, it's a bedtime story, and it's called And Then. And it tells you the first about 8 lines of a story, and then you tell the rest of the story. To which her mother always says, go talk to your father, I'm not that creative. To which I need to respond with, yes, you are. You're made in the image of the creative God. I don't Jesus juke my wife. That doesn't usually work out well. So then what you do, though, is you read the part of the story, right? One of them was the time capsule. And then open the time capsule, and it was, and you get to just finish that story. It's the same idea, right? We are in the story, and we have an opportunity to create the story. And I love that they use the idea of improvising. So examples, Daniel Kirk, I wanted to throw him in there just so you can get a little taste of what what it looks like to have a narrative theologian. He has a PhD in New Testament from Duke. His blog is actually titled Story Theology, Telling the Story of the Story-Bound God. Does it get any more narrative theology than that? So he talks a lot in his recent book on the Synoptic Gospels that tell the story in different ways, and that's the beauty of it, right? And he talks about the idea that imagine a solo versus a full symphony. And so it's not that it would be terrible to have everybody playing the exact same note as opposed to having harmonies and melody. And I don't really know music at all, but I'm trying to talk like I do, right? You can speak into this, right? Tell me. But you get the idea of it, right? Not even just a solo, but if everybody was playing the exact same thing at the exact same tone, it would be a shame, right? You would miss the beauty of the fullness of what that could really be. And so we get the same idea when we look at the Gospels, is that we get a more broad and full understanding of the character and nature of Jesus. Because again, they're telling the story and they're choosing to omit things, but they're also choosing to emphasize things. That was his I think that's his book. A Man Attested by God, the Human Jesus of the Synoptic Gospels. That's his latest book. And then we're going to blow through these real fast. If you want to look them up, you can get more detail on them. I'll just give you the big talking points. So in narrative theology, N.T. Wright actually has kind of come through and said, yeah, we can do this, and here's a 5-act way to do it. I don't know if you're familiar with N.T. Wright, but he loves bullet points, right? So he talks about the first one being creation in Genesis 1 and 2, and you know, very good, not static, what we just talked about. Humanity is God's gardener, image bearer. And then the crisis comes about in 3 through 11 of Genesis. Evil and human rebellion damage God's good world. God doesn't give up, though, and this is the idea of grace that we experience in this. Step 3 is the community, Israel. We find this in Genesis 12 with Abraham, and the idea to be a solution to the problem of sin, and the idea of the new family being a blessing to bless others, right? That's what God tells Abraham in Genesis 12. Act 4 would be in Christ. In the Gospels, we get the idea that Israel failed, right? They didn't keep up to this idea of being a blessing to all the world. And so because of that, God sends Jesus Christ into the world to make up for the failing of Israel. And Jesus demonstrates the reign of God and calls disciples to a radical countercultural community, invites people to become fully human image bearers. I love that, actually. Invites human beings to become fully human, right? We are the image bearers. We have the opportunity to continue that story. How are we going to deal with that, right? And then the final move, and I gave you just really small bullet points, is way more extended parts on this, is the church. The idea of reinventing community is an ambassador of grace, justice, and hope for a broken world. And improve, improvise, renew, and recreate. And so that obviously includes a lot of the New Testament, not just those few verses that I threw up there with Acts and Romans and Revelation, but and there's a fun little picture of N.T. Wright on the Colbert Report. So this is the a little bit of fringe stuff, right? But at the same time, these are the things that are influencing, right? So if you have Yale Divinity, that's not really fringe. That's a big movement, you know. Like there's a whole a whole divinity school that's focusing on this idea of what does post-liberal look like? And how are we going to be a movement of this beyond just postmodern thinking? And it's a big journey, right? We covered basically an entire century of movements that happen in a lot of different phases and a lot of, you know, it's philosophy and it's sociology and it is theology and it's all of those things. And so Daniel Kirk actually, was it Daniel Kirk? I think Daniel Kirk's the one who actually talks about the idea that, or maybe Jack Caputo. I'm sorry, I'm getting them all running together. But the idea that you can't just study theology anymore. You have to study theology and you have to study philosophy and you have to study sociology. And you have to study all of them together because this idea of being, right, runs through all of them. And so we kind of move from this idea of the postmodern, get rid of the meta-narrative, back to the idea that, no, there is a little bit of intertwining where, and it is kind of the idea of the rejection of the liberalism of you can't have the Descartes drawing sharp lines. They run together. And if we don't allow them to be in communication with one another and to be in communion with one another, well, then we're not grasping the fullness of the being of God. Yes, sir. A consensus. I'm not sure I can claim a consensus. Again, I think I can see movements, right? I can see movements where there are a lot of mainline things that are still happening, existing, but there's a lot of, and I don't know if you want to call them fringe or back to the emergent church, right? The emergent church came out of this idea that we're not going to just continue in the status quo because the status quo isn't working anymore. And so for a lot of churches and denominations, the status quo isn't working anymore. And so they are embracing new ideas and new thoughts and continually reinventing themselves with the idea of if we don't, you know, if we're not evolving, we're dying, you know? I mean, even Wesley said, if you're not progressing forward, there is no stagnation, you're moving backwards. That's not a direct quote, don't quote me on that, but that's the idea of it. So I don't know if I fully answered your question, but I see movements emerging. And I mentioned Brian McLaren a few times. I think McLaren was a big one who they're working on what's called the convergence movement, where it's post-denominational, and they're actually saying, don't leave your institutions, but just be a part of something that's going to reinvent and reinvigorate your institutions. So, yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. And the fact that this church is supporting new churches that don't really fit the mold of the old denomination. They only use United Methodist.
Sure. Yep.
The Globe.
Yeah. Yeah, it's back to that suspicion, right? You're suspicious of the institution, of the denomination, right? There's nothing more institutional than denominations, you know? So there is a lot of suspicion that comes with those. And so I think that's why a lot of institutions have moved away from institutional alignments, or at least naming, right? They may still claim the charter or whatever, but a lot of them moving away from it because they're recognizing that a lot of people in this postmodern era, a lot of millennials are really moving away from the idea of big umbrella institutions.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Michelle, you had a question? I know. Look, don't tell Walt that I kept you over. Well, sure. Yeah.
Creating
So, you know, back to Ecclesiastes, there's nothing new under the sun, right? And a lot of what postmodern does is it doesn't just do away with tradition, it actually goes back to a lot of tradition and embraces tradition as an authoritative source, one that we question, right, and don't always just fully agree with because it's there, but you look at it and engage in it. And so a lot of you, if you've heard me talk before, you've heard me say this, but one of the things we've done in the last year is we've implemented centering prayer with our college students and our young adults. And if you aren't familiar with centering prayer, it's essentially silence. And so we begin our worship services with 3 minutes of silence and centering prayer, which you may think 3 minutes, that's nothing. Sit in a gathering like this for 3 minutes in silence and see how awkward and uncomfortable you get if you're not used to being in silence. And let me tell you, millennials and people this age aren't familiar with silence. They're constantly busy. So what we've done is, it's back to the idea of what it said of a countercultural, radical idea of what it means to be embodying this community. And so we've taken a step back and said, they're getting blown up all the time with lights and sounds and noise. We're going to go back to something that's traditional. You know, centering prayer goes back thousands of years, and we're going to implement that just for 3 minutes. And we've seen it change entire rooms where people walk in and they're, just crazy and overwhelmed by the business of the day, and they sit for 3 minutes in silence, and it changes the entire dynamic of a room. So there's little things like that that we can implement, and I think I'm seeing more and more of this too, and I don't have the data for it, but I'm seeing more and more of this idea that I think we're getting back to. I keep saying I'm moving away from programs and getting into more practices in my ministry, and encouraging that with the people that I'm in ministry with. Yeah, and so we're always going to have programs because we're Highland Park United Methodist Church, and that's always going to be the case, but a lot of our programs are going to be working to drive people into practices. And intentionality, right? So it's going to be Friday night dinners with people. You know, people are going to have dinner on Friday night anyway, so to have dinner with people that you're going to have a conversation that's going to build community as opposed to just go out and shoot the shift. the paradigm shift. Yeah, so it's things like that. Okay, I know I kept you over. Next week you're going to talk about Charles Darwin, and luckily I'm not going to be here to do that. Walt can tackle that one. And the rise of opposition to the modern world. So, shall we rise as you're able? I know a lot of you probably have to go, and we'll sing hymn 569. We have a story to tell the nations. How appropriate.